payment of members. Their only hope of success was to secure, as the Radicals had done, the backing of a parliamentary party and of the progressive middle classes. But they deliberately refused to bid for middle-class support. Their leaders quarrelled among themselves and affronted respectable people by threatening and irresponsible speeches. They had no funds, and no organisation such as the Catholic Association had found in the parishes of the Irish clergy, or the Labour Party was to find later in the trade unions. For a time, England was flooded with petitions and pamphlets, but the ferment varied in warmth from one part of the country to another. Whenever conditions improved, the popular temper cooled, and no united national movement emerged as a permanent force. The few unions which then existed soon deserted the cause, and the more prosperous artisans were lukewarm. Agitation revived from time to time in the years that followed, culminating in the revolutionary year of 1848. But in the end, the whole muddled, well-intentioned business came to nothing. Peel drew the right conclusions. He discerned, much more clearly than the Whigs, the causes of the unrest, and, though steadfast against radicalism, he believed that the remedy lay in efficient administration and an enlightened commercial policy. The younger Tories supported him, and like him were oppressed by the division of the country into two nations, the rich and the poor, as portrayed in the novels of a young Jewish member of Parliament called Benjamin Disraeli. A small group of Conservatives were already seeking an alliance with the working men against the middle classes. In 1839, Melbourne offered to resign, but for another 2 years Victoria kept him in office. His charm had captured her affections. He imparted to her much of his wisdom on men and affairs, without burdening her with his scepticism, and she refused to be separated from her beloved Prime Minister. In February of the following year, a new figure entered upon the British scene. The Queen married her cousin, Prince Albert of Saxe-Coburg. The Prince was an upright, conscientious man with far-ranging interests and high ideals. He and the Queen enjoyed for 21 years, until his early death, a happy family life, which held up an example much in accord with the desires of her subjects. After the excesses of George IV and his brothers, the dignity and repute of the monarchy stood in need of restoration, and this was Victoria and Albert's achievement. At first, the Prince found his presence in England resented by the political magnates of the time. They would not let him take a seat in the House of Lords. They cut down his annual allowance, and he was not granted even the title of Prince Consort until 1857. Nevertheless, the patronage which he earnestly extended to science, industry, and the arts, and to good causes of many kinds, gradually won him a wide measure of public respect. As permanent adviser to the Queen, on all issues laid before her, he played a scrupulous, disinterested part. Wise counsels from his uncle, King Leopold, and his former tutor, Baron Stockmar, taught him the role and duties of a constitutional sovereign. Eventually, the party leaders in England learnt to value his advice, especially on foreign affairs, though they did not always pay heed to it. The Queen was a woman of strong mind, who'd begun her reign as a vehement partisan of the Whigs. Under Albert's influence, she came to perceive that in public, at least, she must be impartial, and place her trust in whichever minister could command a majority in the House of Commons. This did not prevent her from entertaining vivid likes and dislikes for her chief servants, to which she gave vigorous expression in private letters. Together, the Queen and the Prince set a new standard for the conduct of monarchy, which has ever since been honourably observed. Peel, unlike Melbourne, had given the Queen an impression of awkwardness and coldness of manner. But at last, in 1841, a general election brought him to power. Before long, he'd won her confidence. His abilities now came into full play. He had absolute control of his cabinet, himself introduced his government's more important budgets, and supervised the work of all departments, including that of William Gladstone, at the Board of Trade. Tariffs were once again reformed, customs duties greatly reduced, and income tax was reimposed. These measures soon bore fruit. In 1843, trade began to revive, prosperity returned, and the demand for political reform was stilled. Once again, the sky seemed clear at Westminster, but a storm was gathering in Ireland. The immediate issue was the price of bread. To promote foreign commerce, Peel had reduced import duties on everything except corn. Dear bread, however, meant either high wages or misery for the masses, and Peel gradually realized that cheap imported food could alone sustain the continued prosperity of the nation. Free trade in corn seemed imperative, but the political obstacles were formidable. The Tory party leaned heavily on the votes of the landowners, who'd invested much capital in their properties during the Napoleonic Wars. Peace had brought cheaper corn from abroad, and the cry for protection had led in 1815 to a prohibition of the import of foreign grain, except when the price in the home market was abnormally high. The repeal or modification of this and later corn laws now overclouded all other issues. The landowners were accused of using their power in Parliament to safeguard their interests at the expense of the rest of the community. The enmity of the manufacturers and industrialists sharpened the conflict, for the corn laws not only caused great distress to the working classes, but angered many employers. Protection, in their view, prevented them from building up new markets overseas and from competing on fair terms in old ones. Hostility to the corn laws had grown during the Depression of 1838 to 1842. An anti-corn law league was formed at Manchester to press for their abolition. It soon exerted a powerful influence on public opinion and produced two remarkable leaders and organisers who became the free trade prophets of 19th century England: Richard Cobden, a calico printer, and John Bright, a Quaker millowner. The movement was strongly supported. There were large subscriptions to its funds. The new penny postage, introduced by Sir Rowland Hill in 1840, carried circulars and pamphlets cheaply all over the country. Meetings were held throughout the land. The propaganda was effective and novel. A few simple ideas hammered into the minds of audiences by picked lecturers and speakers. Never had there been such a shrewdly conducted agitation. Monster petitions were sent to Parliament. Cobden persuaded prosperous townspeople to buy 40-shilling freeholds in the county constituencies and thus secure a double vote. This so increased the number of anti-corn law electors that, instead of only petitioning Parliament from outside, the League started influencing it from within. Cobden and Bright's thundering speeches against the landed classes reverberated through the nation. "Let them go on, and in a short time they'll find themselves like the French nobility previous to the Revolution. An isolated, helpless, powerless class. A class that, in their own inherent qualities, in their intellectual and moral powers, are inferior to any other classes of society. They not only cling to feudal abuses, but they actually try to put a restraint upon the supply of food for the people. They are warring against the progression of the age. They fancy that their feudal system is necessary to the existence of the community. Why, their feudal system has gone in France, it has gone in Germany, in America, it has never existed." Peel, like Cobden and Bright, came from the middle class, and such arguments bit deeply into his mind. England's trade and prosperity demanded the abolition of the Corn Laws, but at least half his supporters were landowners, and such a step would wreck the Conservative Party. By 1843, however, Peel was determined to act. His position was very difficult, for some of his followers felt he had betrayed them once already over Catholic emancipation. But he was sure of himself. Perhaps he believed that his personal ascendancy would carry the majority with him, but he needed time to convince his party, and time was denied him. In August 1845, the potato crop failed in Ireland. Famine was imminent, and Peel could wait no longer. But when he put his proposals to the cabinet, several of his colleagues revolted, and in December he had to resign. The Whig leader Russell refused to form an administration, and Peel returned to office to face and conquer the onslaught of the Tory protectionists. Their spokesman, the hitherto little-known Benjamin Disraeli, denounced him not so much for seeking to abolish the Corn Laws as for betraying his position as head of a great party. If Peel, he declared, believed in the measure, he should resign, as a large section of his party was traditionally pledged to oppose it. The wilful destruction of a great party by its leader was a political crime, for the true working of English politics depended on the balance of parties, and if a leader could not convince his colleagues, he should withdraw. Thus, Disraeli. But Peel maintained that his duty to the nation was higher than his duty to his party, and he believed it was his mission to carry the abolition of the Corn Laws. His private letters reveal his bitterness against the protectionist wing of the Tories. Protectionists, indeed! To close their eyes to the result of every commercial experiment that has been made, to find every one of their predictions falsified, to disregard the state of public opinion, to call the Corn Laws a labourer's question, and yet listen to the appalling facts as to the condition for years past of the labourers in Dorsetshire, to be willing to encounter the tremendous risks of two bad harvests, and the recurrence of such a state of things in Paisley and Stockport as was witnessed in the winters of 1841 and 1842. Not to see that the Corn Laws would be swept away with dishonour on the demand of a starving population? This is to be a protectionist. Thank God I am relieved forever from the trammels of such a party. On June the 25th, 1846, with the help of Whig and Irish votes, the Corn Laws were repealed. Disraeli immediately had his revenge. Turmoil in Ireland destroyed Peel's government, and by a vote on the same night, the great ministry, one of the strongest of the century, came to an end. Peel had been the dominating force and personality in English politics since the passing of the Great Reform Bill. Whether in opposition or in office, he towered above the scene. He was not a man of broad and ranging modes of thought, but he understood better than any of his contemporaries the needs of the country, and he had the outstanding courage to change his views in order to meet them. It is true that he split his party, but there are greater crimes than that. The age over which he presided was one of formidable industrial advance. It was the railway age. By 1848, some 5,000 miles of railroads had been built in the United Kingdom. Speed of transport and increasing output were the words of the day. Coal and iron production had doubled. Engineering was making great, though as yet hesitating, strides. All the steps were being taken not by government, but by enterprises throughout the country, which were to make Britain the greatest industrial power of the 19th century world. Peel had a practical sense of these vast developments. Free trade, he knew, was no cure-all for the pangs and anguish of a changing society, but the days of the landowning predominance were doomed. Free trade seemed essential to manufacture, and in manufacture, Britain was entering upon her supremacy. All this, Peel grasped. His government set an example of initiative, which both the Conservative and Liberal parties honoured by imitation in the future. Of his own methods of government, he once said, "The fact is, people like a certain degree of obstinacy and presumption in a minister. They abuse him for dictation and arrogance, but they like being governed." High words, perhaps, but they fitted the time. Early in 1850, after he'd watched with restraint and composure the totterings of his Whig successors, Peel fell from his horse while riding in the Green Park and was fatally injured. So died one of the great shapers of British politics in the Victorian age. Chapter 4. The Crimean War. Towards the middle of the 19th century, political life in England was still following its long-accustomed habits, which had so far been only slightly changed by the acceptance of the Great Reform Bill. The Whigs were in power under Lord John Russell, whose family had served the state since the days of Henry VII. After 3.5 centuries of generally smiling fortune, the Russells and their friends and connections had acquired an assurance that they knew best how to govern the country in its true interests. Whatever novel agitations might spread among working men in the industrial towns, who as yet enjoyed few votes, the Whig leaders pursued their reasonable, moderate, and undemocratic courses. Lord John's government, with a few upsets, survived for 6 years. It achieved little of lasting note, but it piloted Britain through a restless period when elsewhere in Europe thrones were overturned and revolutions multiplied. The Tories, for their part, were irreconcilably split. The faithful followers of Peel and Free Trade, who included in Aberdeen and Gladstone two future prime ministers, were content to let the Whigs bear the heat of the day. The Liberal Party, which would presently arise from the coalition of Whigs, Peelites and Radicals, was not yet foreseen. The opponents of the Peelites, the old Tories, were led by Lord Stanley, soon to be Lord Derby, whose forebears had played a role in the kingdom for even longer than the Russells. Derby was increasingly assisted in the House of Commons by his lieutenant, Disraeli, whose reputation for brilliance was growing rather faster than his capacity for inspiring trust. It was Disraeli's gradual task over these years to persuade the Tories to abandon their fidelity to the Corn Law Tariff and to work out a new and more broadly based Conservative policy. While party affairs at Westminster dwelt gently in flux, Europe succumbed to an anguished spasm. In February 1848, the French monarchy fell. The rule of King Louis-Philippe had given prosperity to France, or at least to her middle classes, but it had never been accepted by the adherents of the elder Bourbon line, and it appealed neither to staunch Republicans nor to the Bonapartists, who were still dazzled by the remembered glories of the empire. A few days of rioting sufficed to eject Louis-Philippe, and a government of romantic outlook and socialist complexion briefly took control. This in turn collapsed, and by the end of the year, a Bonaparte had been elected President of France by an overwhelming majority. Thus, after half a lifetime spent in plotting, exile, and obscurity, Prince Louis Napoleon, nephew of the great emperor, came to power. He owed his position to the name he bore, to the ineptitude of his rivals, and to the fondness of the French for constitutional experiment. For more than 20 years, this amiable, dreamy figure was to play a striking and not always ineffective part upon the European scene. The peoples of Italy had also broken into revolt against both their own rulers and the Austrian occupiers of Lombardy and Venetia. High hopes were cherished that a united Italian nation might emerge from this commotion. Pope Pius IX, who was also the temporal ruler of central Italy, was a liberal man of patriotic feeling. To him, many of his fellow Italians looked up for guidance and inspiration. But his holy office forbade him to direct a purely national crusade against the Catholic power of Austria. Popes before had fought for local issues. Pius IX was a wiser man. His duty was not to unify a nation, but to head a universal church. Political leadership for Italy had to come from elsewhere. In the Italian provinces, enthusiastic conspirators soon found that they could not hold their own against the organized forces of Austria and her allies, nor could the army of the Kingdom of Sardinia, which was the only wholly independent Italian state, make much impression on Austrian might. The Italian revolt ended in failure, but not without arousing a widespread sympathy in Britain, which was benevolently exercised when the next attempt at unity was made. North of the Alps, revolutionary nationalism was also stirring in Germany, Austria, and Poland. The Austrian Chancellor, Metternich, who had dominated Central Europe for 40 years, was forced to resign by a revolution in Vienna. This aged pillar of continental absolutism found refuge in an obscure hotel in the England of the Whigs. The Emperor was obliged to abdicate, leaving the Habsburg throne to a young Archduke, Francis Joseph, destined to live through many tribulations and witness the opening years of the First World War. Czechs, Poles, and Hungarians, in turn, all took up arms, and their gallant risings were eventually suppressed only with the cordial help of the Tsar of Russia. In Germany itself, the minor monarchs were thrown into disarray, and some into exile, by rebellions and demonstrations. A parliament met at Frankfurt, and after lengthy debate, offered the crown of a united Germany to the King of Prussia. This sovereign and his military advisers preferred repressing revolutionaries to accepting favours from them, and the offer was declined. Little came of the events of 1848 to 1849 in Germany, except a powerful impetus to the idea of German unity, and a growing conviction that it could only be achieved with the backing of Prussian arms. The turmoil in Europe was viewed in England with sympathetic interest, but it went unmatched by any comparable disturbance. The Chartist movement, for some time languishing, took fresh courage from the Republican example in France. It was also stirred by a new economic crisis at home. There was half-hearted talk of revolution, but in the end it was decided to present a new petition to Parliament, reiterating all the old Chartist demands. A meeting was called in April 1848 on Kennington Common, a mile to the south of Westminster Bridge. From there, the Chartist leaders proposed to lead an impressive march upon the Houses of Parliament. The government took precautions. Troops were called out and special constables enrolled. But in the event, no undue strain was placed upon their services. As Wellington remarked, still an imperturbable commander-in-chief at the age of 78, the English are a very quiet people. This is especially so when it is raining. More spectators than Chartists assembled on that wet spring day at Kennington. When the police forbade the proposed march, the demonstrators quietly dispersed. Their petition was conveyed to the Commons in three cabs. Such was the measure of revolutionary feeling in London in 1848. In the same year, Thomas Babington Macaulay, who'd been a minister of the Crown and served the Government of India in high office, published the first volumes of his History of England. This great work, with all its prejudiced opinions and errors of fact, provided the historical background for the sense of progress which was now inspiring Victorian Britain. Macaulay set out to show that the story of England since the Whig Revolution of 1688 was one of perpetual and limitless advance. In his opening chapter he wrote, "The history of our own country in the last 160 years is eminently the history of physical, moral, and intellectual improvement." This was a heartening note, much appreciated by contemporary readers. Optimism reigned throughout the land. An even more shining future, Macaulay implied, lay before the United Kingdom. So indeed it did. His views were widely shared, and were soon given form in the Great Exhibition of British Achievement, which justly gratified the nation. Prince Albert sponsored the idea. There had already been small exhibitions of manufacturers in which he'd taken an interest. In 1849, after opening the new Albert Dock in Liverpool, the Prince had been so much impressed by the surging vigour of British industry and its maritime cause and consequence that he adopted with enthusiasm a plan for an exhibition on a far larger scale than had ever been seen before. It would display to the country and the world the progress achieved in every field. It would also be international, proclaiming the benefits of free trade between nations and looking forward to the universal peace, which it was then supposed must inevitably result from the unhampered traffic in goods. Few people foresaw the war with Russia that was soon to break out. For 2 years, against considerable opposition, the Prince headed a committee to further his project. In 1851, the Great Exhibition was opened in Hyde Park. 19 acres were devoted to the principal building, the Crystal Palace, designed by an expert glasshouse gardener, Joseph Paxton. Housing most of the exhibits, and enclosing whole trees within its glass and iron structure, it was to be the marvel of the decade. In spite of prophecies of failure, the exhibition was a triumphant success. Over 1 million people a month visited it during the 6 months of its opening. Nearly 14,000 exhibits of industrial skill and craft were shown, of which half were British. The prince was vindicated, and the large profit made by the organizers was invested and put to learned and educational purposes. Queen Victoria described the opening day as one of the greatest and most glorious in our lives. Her feelings were prompted by her delight that Prince Albert should have confounded his critics, ever ready to accuse him of meddling in national affairs. But there was more to it than that. The Queen paid many visits to the Crystal Palace, where her presence aroused, in the scores of thousands of subjects with whom she mingled, a deep loyalty and a sense of national pride. Never had the throne been so firmly grounded in the affections of the people. Prosperity, however unevenly its blessings fell, gave Britain a self-assurance that seemed worth more than social legislation and further reform. From mills and mines and factories flowed the wealth that was making life easier for the country. And this the country recognized. The mid-century marks the summit of Britain's preponderance in industry. In another 20 years, other nations, among whom industrial progress had started later, had begun to cut down her lead. Until 1870, Britain had mined more than half the world's coal, and in that year her output of pig iron was still greater than the rest of the world's put together. Foreign trade stood at a figure of nearly 700 million sterling, as compared with 300 for the United States, 340 for France, and 300 for Germany. But the proportions were rapidly changing. Railways greatly assisted the growth of industry in Germany and America, where coal and iron resources were separated from each other by considerable distances. A challenge was also presented to British agriculture, now that prairie-grown American wheat could be carried to American ports by railroad and shipped across the ocean to European markets. Nevertheless, there was no slowing down of industry in Britain. Textiles, the backbone of British exports, filled an insatiable demand in Asia, and the future of the mighty steel and engineering industries seemed assured for a long time to come. In England, the rapidly expanding Midlands and North were blackened by the smoke and dust of the pits and forges. Critics were not wanting of the age of mass production that was now taking shape. Charles Dickens, in his novels, revealed the plight of the poor, holding up to pity the conditions in which many of them dwelt, and ridiculing the state institutions that crudely encompassed them. John Ruskin was another. In the midst of his long life, he turned from the study of painting and architecture to modern social problems. His heart lay in the Middle Ages, which he imagined to be peopled by a fraternity of craftsmen harmoniously creating works of art. Peering out upon the Victorian scene, this prophetic figure looked in vain for similar accomplishment. Bad taste in manufacture, bad relations between employers and men, aroused his eloquent wrath. His was a voice that cried the way both to new movements in the arts and to socialism in politics. Foreign affairs and the threat of war now began to darken the scene. Turkey had troubled the statesmen of Europe for many years. Preoccupation with the conflicts and intrigues of court and harem had so distracted the sultans at Constantinople and their chief advisers from the duties of government and even of defence, that the military empire, which for 3 centuries had dominated the eastern world from the Persian Gulf to Budapest and from the Caspian to Algiers, seemed now on the edge of disruption and collapse. What then would become of its vast territories? To whom would fall the wide, fertile Turkish provinces in Europe and Asia? The urgency and imminence of such questions were sharpened by the evident determination of Russia to seize the Danubian lands, Constantinople, and the Black Sea. England could not ignore the threat. The shadow of Russia, already a formidable Asiatic power, appeared to be creeping over India. The anxiety and apprehension of the governing circles of England marched with a widespread and hearty dislike of the whole political system of which Nicholas I, the icy Muscovite and o'ergrown barbarian of the East, in Tennyson's phrases, was the principal prop and pillar in Europe. The contemporaries of Palmerston looked upon the police state of the Tsar as the cornerstone of despotism in the world. The oppressor of the Poles, the ally of reactionary Austria, a fatal obstacle to the liberation of nations and the realization of the great hopes which had sprung from the liberal revolutions of 1848. The need to resist Russia was plain to most British observers, though radicals like Cobden strongly opposed this view. British diplomacy was confused about the best way of achieving its aims. For it was also necessary to keep an eye on the French, who had ambitions for extending their influence in the Levant. Canning had planned to head Russia off from Southeast Europe, not by direct opposition, but by founding on the ruins of the Turkish Empire a bloc of small independent states who would stand firm, and if necessary, fight for the sake of their own survival. With such a program of emancipation, he'd hoped to associate not only France, but Russia herself. The creation of the Kingdom of Greece was the first and only result of his efforts. But 20 years had gone by, and the ruling politicians of England had forgotten the example of Byron, who died for Greek freedom. They reversed the policy of Canning, and now attempted to check Russian expansion by the opposite method of propping up the decaying system of Turkish rule in Southeast Europe. In the execution of this plan, the government was much assisted by Stratford Canning, later Lord Stratford de Radcliffe, the British ambassador at Constantinople in the 1840s. He was a cousin of George Canning, with a wider knowledge of Turkey, which he'd first visited in 1808, than any other Englishman of his day. Proud, difficult, quick-tempered, he enjoyed immense authority with the Turks. He had no illusions about the character of the Ottoman Empire, which he described as hastening to its dissolution. But he hoped to induce the Sultan to make such reforms as would retard the evil hour when it would finally collapse, and so postpone a general war for possession of its territories. For years, Stratford struggled with the laziness, corruption, and inefficiency of the Turkish administration. Whether he was wise to do so is another matter, since any tightening up of central authority would have increased tension between Constantinople and the provinces. It was the very laxity of the regime that made it bearable by the subject peoples. Stratford, however, was unconvinced of this, and when he left Constantinople in 1852, he had little hope that the evil hour could be delayed much longer. The immediate source and origin of the conflict which now came to a head between Turkey and Russia lay in Jerusalem, where the Greek Orthodox and Roman Catholic churches disputed the custody of certain shrines. The quarrel would have been unimportant had not the Tsar supported the Greek pretensions, and Louis Napoleon, now the Emperor Napoleon III, been anxious to please French Catholics by championing the Latins. After long negotiation, the Tsar sent his envoy Menshikov to Constantinople to revive his claims for a general protectorate over the Christians in the Turkish Empire. This, if granted, would have given Russia authority over the many millions of Romanians, Serbs, Bulgarians, Greeks, and Armenians within the Ottoman domains. The balance of power, for which British governments always sought in the Near East, as elsewhere, would have been destroyed. Menshikov was tactless, and his demands angered the Turks. The electric telegraph, recently invented, only reached to Belgrade. Upon Stratford, who'd returned to his embassy, much depended. He was the man on the spot, with considerable freedom from cabinet control, and with strong views on the Russian danger and the need to support Turkey. At home, Lord Derby, after a brief spell in office, had been succeeded by Lord Aberdeen, who presided over a coalition government of Whigs and Peelites, far from united in their opinions. The Prime Minister himself and his Foreign Secretary, Lord Clarendon, were hesitant and favoured appeasement. But Stratford could count on Palmerston, the most popular man in the cabinet, and on the general hostility in England towards the Russians. Stratford's dispatches do not support the charge that he exceeded his instructions. He recommended the Turks to continue negotiations and not to take too stiff an attitude. But the Turks knew their man. They knew they had his sympathy, and they knew that in the last resort the British fleet would protect Constantinople and stop Russia seizing the straits. They accordingly rejected the Russian demands, and on June 2, 1853, the Russian attitude had become so menacing that the cabinet ordered the British fleet to Beshika Bay outside the Dardanelles. Napoleon III, eager for British approval and support, agreed to provide a French squadron. The fleet reached Beshika Bay on June the 13th. In early July, Russian troops crossed the River Prut and entered Turkish Moldavia. The British cabinet was still divided, and neither warned the Russians nor promised help to the Turks. The Turks ended the matter by rejecting an offer of mediation by a council of ambassadors. Stratford disapproved of this proposal, known as the Vienna Note, but there is no evidence that he failed to carry out his instructions to advise the Turks to yield. This they could not do, since feeling ran so high at Constantinople that the Sultan had little choice but to refuse. War was not yet certain. The Tsar, alarmed at Turkey's resistance, sought a compromise with the help of Austria, but by September Aberdeen and his cabinet had become so suspicious that they rejected the offer. On October the 4th, the Sultan declared war on Russia, and soon afterwards attacked the Russians beyond the Danube. Such efforts as Aberdeen and Stratford could still make for peace were extinguished by a Russian onslaught against the Turkish fleet off Sinope in the Black Sea. Indignation flared in England, where the action was denounced as a massacre. Palmerston sent in his resignation in December on a domestic issue, but his action was interpreted as a protest against the government's eastern policy, and Aberdeen was accused of cowardice. Thus England drifted into war. In February 1854, Nicholas recalled his ambassadors from London and Paris, and at the end of March, the Crimean War began, with France and Britain as the allies of Turkey. To the last, Aberdeen vacillated. "I still say that war is not inevitable," he futilely wrote to Clarendon in February, "unless indeed we are determined to have it, which, for all I know, may be the case." The operations were ill-planned and ill-conducted on both sides. With the exception of two minor naval expeditions to the Baltic and the White Sea, fighting was confined to southern Russia, where the great naval fort of Sebastopol in the Black Sea was selected as the main Allied objective. The necessity for this enterprise was questionable. The Turks had already driven the Russians out of the Danube Valley, there was little danger of an attack upon Constantinople, and it was folly to suppose that the capture of Sebastopol would make much impression on the vast resources of Russia. However, the British expeditionary force was encamped in Turkish territory, and some use had to be made of it. Orders from London dispatched it to the Crimea against the wishes of its commander, Lord Raglan. The Allied fleet sailed close by Sebastopol harbour, and ceremonial salutes were exchanged between the belligerents. A landing was made at the small town of Yevpatoria to the northwest. The Russian governor declared that the armies might land, but according to regulations, ought immediately to be placed in quarantine. Nobody took any notice of this precaution. Sebastopol might have been entered by an immediate attack from the north, yet after an initial victory on the Alma in September 1854, the French commander, Saint-Arnoux, who was a sick man and a political appointment, insisted on marching round to the south and beginning a formal siege. With this step, Raglan reluctantly concurred. It was against his better judgment. The Russians were thus permitted to bring up reinforcements and strengthen the fortifications under the direction of the famous engineer Tortleben. Unable to complete their investment of the town, the Allies had to beat off fresh Russian field armies which arrived from the interior. The British army, holding the exposed eastern wing of the lines, had twice to bear the brunt. At Balaclava in October, the British cavalry distinguished themselves by two astonishing charges against overwhelming odds. The second of these was the celebrated Charge of the Light Brigade, in which 673 horsemen, led by Lord Cardigan, rode up the valley under heavy fire, imperturbably, as if taking part in a review, to attack the Russian batteries. They captured the guns, but only a third of the brigade answered the first muster after the charge. Lord Cardigan calmly returned to the yacht on which he had lived, had a bath, dined, drank a bottle of champagne, and went to bed. His brigade had performed an inspiring feat of gallantry, but it was due, like much else in this war, to the blunders of commanders. Lord Raglan's orders had been badly expressed and were misunderstood by his subordinates. The light brigade had charged the wrong guns. The Battle of Inkerman followed, fought in the mists of a November dawn. It was a desperate infantry action in which the British soldier proved his courage and endurance. Russian casualties were nearly five times as many as those of the Allies. But Inkerman was not decisive. The Russians outnumbered the Allies by 2-1, and it became plain that there was no hope of taking Sebastopol before the spring of 1855. Amid storms and blizzards the British army lay, without tents, huts, food, warm clothes, or the most elementary medical care. Cholera, dysentery, and malarial fever took their dreadful toll. Raglan's men had neither transport nor ambulances, and thousands were lost through cold and starvation, because it did not occur to the government of the greatest engineering country in the world to ease the movement of supplies from the port of Balaclava to the camp by laying down 5 miles of light railway. Nearly half a century of peace had dimmed the glory of the army which defeated Napoleon. Its great chief, Wellington, had died amid national mourning in 1852. During his long reign as Commander-in-Chief at the War Office, nothing had changed since Waterloo. Nor could his successors in office see any need for reforming the army which the Duke had led. The conditions of service were intolerable. The administration was bad, the equipment scanty, the commanders of no outstanding ability. The French and British between them had only 56,000 troops in the Crimea in the terrible winter of 1854 to 1855. Nearly 14,000 of them went to hospital, and many died for want of medical supplies. Most of these casualties were British. The French were much better provided for, while the Russians, who accepted official mismanagement as a matter of course, perished in uncounted numbers on the long route marches through the snow southwards to the Crimea. Fighting the war for the sake of Sebastopol imposed a heavy burden upon the government of the Tsar. He might have been wiser to have withdrawn his troops into the interior of Russia, as his brother had done in the days of Napoleon's invasion. But neither side in the Crimean War was inspired by large strategic views. Even the War Office was a little shaken by the incompetence and suffering. The Times, under its great editor, J.T. Delane, sent out the first of all war correspondents, William Russell, and used his reports to start a national agitation against the government. Aberdeen was assailed from every quarter, and when Parliament reassembled in January, a motion was introduced by a private member to appoint a commission of inquiry into the state of the army before Sebastopol. It was carried by a majority so large that when the figures were announced, they were greeted, not with the usual cheers, but with surprised silence, followed by derisive laughter. The government had been condemned, as a contemporary wrote, to the most ignominious end of any cabinet in modern days. Aberdeen resigned and was succeeded by Palmerston, who accepted the commission of inquiry. Palmerston did not at first command wide confidence, and it was at this moment that Disraeli wrote privately of him, "He is really an impostor, utterly exhausted, and at the best only ginger beer and not champagne, and now an old painted pantaloon." Disraeli was wrong. Palmerston soon proved himself a man of the hour. The worst mistakes and muddles were cleared up, and at the War Office, Sidney Herbert struggled manfully to reform the military administration. By the summer of 1855, the Allied armies had been reinforced and were in good heart. An assault on Sebastopol was mounted in June, but it failed. This was too much for Raglan. Worn out by the responsibilities of the campaign, he resigned, and 10 days later, he died. Raglan had been ill-served by his government and by his quarrelsome subordinates, and he too readily let his good judgment be overridden. This disciple of Wellington, who'd lost an arm at Waterloo, deserves a higher niche in military history than is sometimes accorded him. He was brave, loyal, and had the misfortune frequently to be right when others took the wrong decision. The victory that should have been his due was won by his successor, Sir James Simpson, in conjunction with the French Marshal Pelissier. In September, Sebastopol at last fell. The futility of the plan of campaign was now revealed. It was impossible to invade Russia from the Crimea. What should the next move be? France by now had four times as many troops in the field as England, and Napoleon III was threatening to withdraw them. A peace party in Paris was making its views felt. The French Emperor was inclined to negotiate, meanwhile reducing operations against Russia to a mere blockade. If the war were to continue, he felt, other powers would have to be drawn in, and an appeal made to the national sentiments of Poles, Swedes, and other hereditary enemies of the Tsar. This was too grandiose even for Palmerston. He privately denounced the French Peace Party as a cabal of stock-jobbing politicians, but he realized the war must stop. Threatened by an Austrian ultimatum, Russia agreed to terms, and in February 1856 a peace conference opened in Paris. The Treaty of Paris, signed at the end of March, removed the immediate causes of the conflict, but provided no permanent settlement of the Eastern question. Russia surrendered her grip on the mouth of the Danube by abandoning southern Bessarabia. Her claims to a protectorate over the Turkish Christians were set aside. The Dardanelles were closed to foreign ships of war during peace, as they had been before the war, and Turkey's independence was guaranteed by the powers, in return for a promise of reforms which was not worth the paper it was written on. Russia accepted the demilitarization of the Black Sea, but repudiated her undertaking when Europe was absorbed by the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. For the time being, her expansion was checked, but she remained unappeased. Within 20 years, Europe was nearly at war again over Russian ambitions in the Near East. The fundamental situation was unaltered. So long as Turkey was weak, so long would her empire remain a temptation to Russian imperialists and an embarrassment to Western Europe. With one exception, few of the leading figures emerged from the Crimean War with enhanced reputations. Miss Florence Nightingale had been sent out in an official capacity by the Secretary at War, Sidney Herbert. She arrived at Scutari on the day before the Battle of Inkerman, and there organized the first base hospital of modern times. With few nurses and scanty equipment, she reduced the death rate at Scutari from 42 per 100 to 22 per 1,000 men. Her influence and example were far-reaching. The Red Cross movement, which started with the Geneva Convention of 1864, was the outcome of her work, as were great administrative reforms in civilian hospitals. In an age of proud and domineering men, she gave the women of the 19th century a new status, which revolutionized the social life of the country, and even made them want to vote. Miss Nightingale herself felt that there are evils which press much more hardly on women than the want of the suffrage. Lack of education was one, and she favoured better girls' schools and the founding of women's colleges. To these objects she devoted her attention, and by her efforts half the Queen's subjects were encouraged to enter the realms of higher thought. Chapter 5. Palmerston. Palmerston, though now in his 70s, presided over the English scene. With one short interval of Tory government, he was Prime Minister throughout the decade that began in 1855. Not long after the signing of peace with Russia, he was confronted with another emergency, which also arose in the East, but this time in Asia. India had been basking under the administration of the East India Company, with only a moderate degree of supervision from London. The company had its critics in Parliament and elsewhere, but their words had little effect upon its practices. Suddenly there occurred a disturbing outbreak against British rule. The Indian Mutiny made, in some respects, a more lasting impact on England than the Crimean War. It paved the way for empire. After it was over, Britain gradually and consciously became a worldwide imperial power. The causes of the mutiny lay deep in the past. About the beginning of the 19th century, a new generation of British administrators and soldiers appeared in India, austere, upright, Bible-reading men, who dreamed of Christianizing and Europeanizing the subcontinent, and for a while gained a brief promise of success. Hitherto, the English, like the Romans in the provinces of their empire, had a neutral policy on religion and no policy at all on Indian education. Regiments held ceremonial parades in honour of Hindu deities, and Hindu and Muslim holidays were impartially and publicly observed. But in England, missionary zeal was stirring, and respect for alien creeds gradually succumbed to the desire for proselytization. For a time, enlightened Hindu opinion seemed not unreceptive to elements of the Christian faith. Sati, the burning of widows, thuggee, the strangling of travellers by fanatics who deemed it a religious duty, and female infanticide were suppressed. Largely owing to Macaulay, when he was a member of the Governor-General's Council, measures were taken to make English learning available to the higher-ranking and more wealthy Indians. All this was unsettling, and played its part in the terrible events which now occurred. A more immediate cause of the rising was a series of defeats and reverses suffered by the British. The Russian threat to India had begun to overhang the minds of Englishmen. It was, in fact, a gross exaggeration to suppose that Russian armies could have crossed the ranges of the Hindu Kush in force and arrived in the Indus Valley. But the menace seemed real at the time. When it was learnt that a small body of Russians had penetrated into the fringes of Afghanistan, a British expedition was dispatched in 1839 to Kabul, and a British candidate placed on the Afghan throne. The result was disaster. The country rose up in arms. In December 1841, under a promise of safe conduct, the British garrison of some 4,000 troops, accompanied by nearly three times as many women, children, and Afghan camp followers, began to withdraw through the snow and the mountain passes. The safe conduct was violated, and nearly all were murdered or taken prisoners. Only a handful of survivors reached India in the following January. A second expedition avenged the treachery in the following year, but the repute of European arms was deeply smitten, and the massacre resounded throughout the peninsula. Another defeat soon followed in the Punjab, the most northerly of the Indian provinces at that time. Here the warrior Sikhs, a reformed Hindu sect forbidden to touch tobacco or cut their hair above the waist, had long held sway. Encouraged by the news from Afghanistan, and restless after the death of their great leader Ranjit Singh, who had hitherto held them in check, they resolved to try their hand at invading the company's territory. In 1845, they crossed the boundary river of the Sutlej and were met and repulsed 200 miles north of Delhi. The British installed a regency. 3 years later, the Sikhs tried to overthrow it. There was a desperate, drawn battle deep within the province of Chilianwala, in which three British regiments lost their colours. Shortly afterwards, the British forces redeemed their name and the Sikh army was destroyed. The Punjab was pacified by John and Henry Lawrence. These famous brothers ruled with absolute power, untrammelled by the company and splendidly resourceful. They made landowners take a threefold oath. Thou shalt not burn thy widow, thou shalt not kill thy daughters, thou shalt not bury alive thy lepers. They sent the Kohinoor diamond to Queen Victoria, and gained from the formidable warriors of the province an affection and loyalty for the British crown, which was to endure for nearly a century. One of their subordinates, John Nicholson, who was to be forever famous as the liberator of Delhi, was even worshipped by some Punjabis as a deity. Nevertheless, among the ill-informed and ill-disposed in other regions of India, "Remember Chilianwala" became a battle cry and a blood-stained slogan in the upheaval which was to come. This was a period of confident expansion in India, generally undertaken by men on the spot, and not always approved by opinion in Britain. Two other major annexations completed the extension of British rule. Possession of Sindh in the lower Indus Valley had been judged necessary to safeguard the command of the northwest coast. It was conquered by Sir Charles Napier, a veteran who'd fought at Coruña, and in the American War of 1812. In England, the magazine Punch commented sourly on this operation. It represented Napier as reporting the matter in a one-word telegram, Peccavi, I have sinned. Napier, unperturbed, proceeded to rule with absolute and benevolent power. He dealt with widow burning by the simple expedient of placing a gibbet beside every pyre. When men burn women alive, we hang them, he said. Like the Punjab, Sindh remained peaceful for many years. The other annexation was that of Oude on the borders of Bengal, where an Indian king had long oppressed his subjects. The Marquess of Dalhousie, appointed Governor-General at the age of 35, had no doubts about the benefits conferred on India by British rule and British skill. During his 8 years of office, he added principalities to the company's dominion by applying what was called the Doctrine of Lapse. This meant that when an Indian ruler died without an heir of his own blood, his territory was forfeited. Adopted heirs were not allowed to inherit, though this had long been Hindu custom. In Oude, Dalhousie was more forthright. He bluntly declared that the British government would be guilty in the sight of God and man if it were any longer to aid in sustaining by its countenance an administration fraught with suffering to millions. He deposed the king and seized his province in 1856. Next year came the mutiny, and much of the blame for provoking it was laid at Dalhousie's door. The East India Company's Army of Bengal had long been of ill repute. Recruited mainly in the north, it was largely composed of high-caste Hindus. This was bad for discipline. Brahmin privates would question the orders of officers and NCOs of less exalted caste. Power and influence in the regiments frequently depended on a man's position in the religious rather than the military hierarchy.